This is The Guardian.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
First, it was a parliamentary researcher. Now we find out that the security services warned against allowing two Tory party candidates to stand for election in case they were spying for China. The Conservative Party's so-called Sino-skeptics, such as Liz Truss, are having a field day.
What we need to do is to recognise that China is the largest threat, both to the world and to the United Kingdom.
Meanwhile, away from foreign policy, the focus has turned to dangerous dogs. That's the sound of the viral video of an American bully dog on the rampage in Birmingham. So is banning that breed the answer? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. Joining me today from a somewhat noisy office in Westminster are The Guardian's political editor Pippa Creerauer and Dan Sabah, our defence and security editor. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Today we will be talking about alleged espionage in the heart of Westminster, what that story might tell us about China and the Conservative Party's relationship with that country and its government. And after that, we'll be looking at the fact that the government is said to be seriously considering whether to ban American bully dogs and disposable vapes. Right, let's talk about Westminster spies or allegations of such things. Over the weekend, the Sunday Times published allegations that someone was spying for China within Westminster. Since then, the Times has named that person, but for legal reasons, we're not going to. He, it is said, is a man in his late 20s who was arrested back in March. No charges had been brought at the time this podcast was recorded, and he's issued a complete denial. So, Dan, what do we know?
Well, as your summary already suggests, this is rather smoke. Like all good espionage stories, this is a sort of smoky and difficult business. What we do know is two people were arrested actually 6 months ago in March on suspicion of offences breaching the old 1911 Official Secrets Act, basically the sort of the catch-all legislation that's historically been used for bringing espionage prosecutions in the UK. This, however, remained quiet. It was basically kept under the radar. And although we've now established senior politicians knew and knew at the time, and one or two of the other MPs involved, no one knew for months, 6 months. One of the individuals is of greater interest than others than the other for now. As you said, is a parliamentary aide, worked with a number of Conservative MPs, seems to have moved in Conservative circles predominantly from what we know, working for, in particular, Tom Tugendhat, who's now the Security Minister, but this is when he was a backbench MP, and more recently for Alicia Kearns, who is the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee.
Now, there is another element to this story, which is sort of broken overnight. In relation to when we're recording this. It is said now that the Conservative Party, in quotes, acted swiftly to block two potential parliamentary candidates from standing for election after warnings from MI5. They could be spying for China. So there's now large amounts of this in the air. Let's quickly hear a bit of the exchange between Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak at PMQs on Wednesday.
Did the Foreign Secretary raise this specific case when he visited China? Yes or no?
Mr. Speaker, I'll refer to the Honourable Gentleman to my previous answer, where I've said very clearly that the Foreign Secretary raised
these issues with the Chinese foreign minister who he met, as did I when I had my meeting with Premier Li over the weekend. But when it comes to China, Mr. Speaker, this government has put in place the most robust policy that has existed ever in our country's foreign policy. It is to protect our country, to protect our country for the values and the interests that we stand up for. It is to align our approach with our closest allies, including those in the G7 and the Five Eyes, and is to engage where it makes sense, either to advance our interests or, as I did at the weekend, to raise our very significant concerns.
Now, any mention of spies in Westminster inevitably feels a bit John le Carré. We've seen this happen before recently. Barry Gardner, the Labour MP, received £500,000 from Christine Lee, a Chinese lawyer, who in 2022 was accused of carrying out political interference activities on behalf of the Chinese Communist Party. She denied wrongdoing and is suing MI5. So it's not like there haven't been these stories before. How common is this kind of stuff, even as tittle-tattle and rumour?
Well, I think what's interesting here is that over the last sort of five, six, seven, 8 years, really since, I guess, the rise of Xi Jinping in as president of China, we've seen a much more aggressive attitude from China in terms of espionage and espionage activity internationally. I mean, this is part of the generally more assertive approach that China has taken and is seeing itself as a kind of competitor state, a rival to the United States and the West. Big countries spy. You know, spying is something that happens. What's embarrassing is getting caught. And what causes the diplomatic arguments is what you say about what you're prepared to say about it in public. But what is interesting about this case is that China has been stepping up its activities and is showing greater interest in trying to understand better what's going on in British Parliament. I mean, you could argue it could just pay, perhaps it could pay a lobbying firm or even read the pages of The Guardian and other newspapers to find out what was going on.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, they have been. And what's potentially interesting about this case, and these are allegations and there's no prosecution, and of course, the individual concerned is we understand he's a Briton. So traditionally, China has sort of concentrated its espionage activities working through its diaspora. There are Chinese diaspora in every country in the world. But on this occasion, this would appear to be a step change.
Okay. Pippa, what's your sense of how much people are talking about it and how much people are worried about it in Westminster?
It's really been the subject of the week. It came up at PMQs this week as well, when Keir Starmer challenged Rishi Sunak over what the government knew, demanded a full audit of UK-China ties, and suggested that he'd left the country vulnerable. But it's also being talked about in the bars and in the corridors of Westminster, particularly with the suggestion that MI5 had warned Tories that a couple of their MP candidates might be spies. It wasn't just this one-off about a parliamentary researcher. And within the Conservative Party, it's been an issue which has really struck a chord with many of them over many years. There's two main groups of Conservative MPs that of Sino-Skeptic Conservative MPs, and they've always been quite territorial about their patches. But in the last few days, that has really blown open. And they've descended into outright rivalry.
So, yeah, this takes us into divisions in the Tory party between so-called hawks who want to label China officially as a hostile state and another body of Tory MPs, broadly speaking, who don't think we're there, right? And perhaps for economic reasons, among all others, would tend to downplay their view of China compared to that sort of verdict. I think at the moment, the official definition of what swirls around the UK's relationship with China is that it poses, quote, an epoch-defining and systemic challenge, unquote. Dan, do you suspect that the tensions between those two points of view is now going to increase? Something rotten?
A lot of this is virtue signalling in the Conservative Party. Designating China as a threat would really put it on a par with Russia, which is officially an acute threat, and its invasion of Ukraine shows it as such. Its willingness to poison people on the streets of the UK is another demonstration of that. I mean, one has to be clear, no serious ally of the UK calls China a threat. You know, Joe Biden asked the Defence Department to just, you know, sees China as a pacing challenge, that China, in other words, is the military threat that the Pentagon must mark itself against, but it doesn't use the word threat.
But it's inconceivable that a country as bound up in our economy in a very, very sizable way, and sort of by extension, the administration of government and so on, if you look at the Chinese involvement in nuclear power, for example, right? How on earth could you balance calling that country a threat when it's as bound up in your domestic affairs as China is?
Well, these are some of the complexities you see. Although, you know, Russia was quite bound up in our domestic affairs. You know, there was Russian ownership of Chelsea Football Club, and an awful lot of oligarchs were spending time in London. Yet the invasion of Ukraine happened.
Otherwise, you weren't going shopping on a Saturday and filling your basket, you know, 50% with products made in China, which is the reality of the British economy.
Yeah, I think these things, to some extent, these things are a complicated balancing act. And what is, you know, and it is true that China is not a sort of overt military threat to the UK. You're absolutely right. There's a sort of, you know, much more complicated economic relationship than there was with Russia. Although I think it wasn't probably the best idea now dropped to have China building British nuclear power stations. Do you think that was a good idea? I don't.
No, it looked very strange at the time. We'll talk about that in a moment. Pippa, where's James Cleverly, the Foreign Secretary, in the midst of all this? I don't mean geographically, I mean in terms of his point of view.
Well, the pendulum has swung back and forth in the Conservative Party and British government over the last sort of decade or so. And there was that golden era, I suppose, they would see it like that, in economic relations, which David Cameron and George Osborne favoured when they were in power, in which, you know, the Chinese were invited to invest in our infrastructure, as Dan mentioned, and trade increased between the two countries. And it's kind of swung back and forth most recently with Liz Truss, obviously, who was a real Sino-skeptic and wanted to designate China a threat. And then it feels like it swung back under Rishi Sunak and James Cleverly to the more sort of economic, pragmatic approach, aware perhaps that there's more than £100 billion worth of trade between the two countries every year, that they're a massive trading partner for us. And I went to a summit, an international summit with James Cleverly earlier this year and interviewed him about China. And he was very clear that Britain shouldn't, to use his words, pull the shutters down on China, that it'd be counterproductive to our national interests. It was so irrevocably tied economically, you know, with the future of tech and AI and things, that it'd be damaging to us economically. It wouldn't be worth doing. And he warned Tory hawks that it couldn't be a binary choice, as many of them seem to see it as, between treating China as a threat or treating it as an opportunity, and suggesting that the UK's approach needs to be more nuanced. But that message, particularly in the last few days when we've had China spying allegations, is really complicated the sort of the viewpoint on the back benches and amongst these two main, the China Research Group and the Interparliamentary Alliance on China. That message has gone down, had already gone down badly, and this week in particular, it's a reminder to them why they are so sceptical about China and crucially China's interest in the UK.
Dan, you mentioned a moment ago what was going on sort of 7 or 8 years ago, which does seem like something from a different age now, arguably. David Cameron took President Xi for a pint near Chequers. George Osborne, who was then the Chancellor of the Exchequer, showed him around Manchester Airport. And the government talked a lot and very loudly about a partnership between the two countries, which woven through that was this idea, I suppose, which was still just about fashionable in the West, that China over time would, in its own way, would, you know, move a bit more closer to sort of democratic norms and so on. When you look back at that, I guess one wonders were Cameron Osborne a bit naive about the situation, do you think?
I think they were the tail end of this sort of post-Cold War moment, which is now well and truly past.
The end of history and all that stuff.
Yes, and I think in the end of history, the belief was that if you could trade with an authoritarian regime, it would eventually, capitalism would inevitably lead to democracy, and it would inevitably sort of change and alter. And it finally, you know, exploded with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, because the reality is that economic engagement with Russia and China has not made a difference to the, you know, either country. These are both highly authoritarian regimes. So that policy has clearly failed. And I think that Cameron and Osborne, right at the back end of that, let's get some more inward investment capital into the UK. And they've been shown up for being naive, because look, the reality is that China and Russia do see themselves as, and clearly defining themselves as, competitor nations to the West, forming an alternative bloc.
One thing among many strikes me about this story, which is that, these allegations suggest that China isn't terribly ambitious, maybe, as far as its espionage is concerned, right? This is not a person or people, if we look at that story about allegations about Conservative candidates, who were at the heart of government, right? This isn't Philby and McLean and those people back in the Cold War, who really
this
had a lot
really
of
important.
Access to a lot of secret information and so on, right? This is somebody who you and I would walk around the parliamentary estate and we think, oh, well, there's another spad.
Yeah, and this is tremendously important insofar as we can. And of course, one fact can change, you know, one new fact can change our understanding. But let's look at the allegations here. So we're saying that this is a researcher who worked for, you know, a couple of upwardly mobile, well plugged in, well known Conservative MPs. Yes. But even as chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, one might be on the telly quite a lot. But do you see classified documents, papers? You do not. So this is not someone who's sort of getting hold of secret information about the inner workings of the British state. Certainly not. I guess the question is this someone who might have been trying to influence and shape policy of the people around them? Well, we don't know. And of course, they're denying all the allegations that are, this individual has denied all the allegations that have been sort of circulating, the allegations of espionage. Or could it be the case that there's a kind of sort of softer information, the kind of gossipy information that swirls around Westminster, who likes who, maybe who drinks a lot, maybe who's got financial problems, whatever the back chat in an MP's office, that might have some value. But to be honest, could you not get that from, as I said earlier, could you not get that from reading the papers? The truth is that we don't understand Beijing brilliantly, but equally, they really don't understand us. And if they think this is valuable information, it's a curiosity that they do.
As you understand it, do we have any people ourselves sort of hanging around the outer fringes of the Chinese government machine, finding out which Chinese politicians drink a lot and might have financial problems?
Are you asking me whether Britain has spies in China? The answer to that question is, of course, yes.
And that work at this outwardly somewhat sort of piffling level.
I am sure. Who knows precisely what goes on? But does the UK have, you know, run spies in countries like China and Russia to sort of better divine the intentions of Politburos and Kremlins? Yes, of course it does. Everyone, that's the point. Everyone spies and no one. But you know, the problem is getting caught. It's embarrassing to get caught. It's not embarrassing to do it.
Two last questions, Pippa. Firstly, I wonder about how this will play politically. Do you think, at least in some small way, it will add to the impression that the Rishi Sunak government is now sort of locked into incompetence and on any given week, another sort of bad thing happening in the general sense that things are falling apart?
Well, it's slightly different from some of the other bad things, as you called them, that has happened. You know, schools crumbling, concrete crumbling in schools, and prisoners breaking out of prisons. But it definitely adds to the sense that, if not that nothing is working, that Rishi Sunak doesn't really have control of the agenda, and that stuff keeps going wrong for him, that he's unlucky. And whether that luck is dictated by his own party's time in government, and this is where we've ended up, or whether it's a more personal thing, I think the public will decide for themselves. But he does have a lot. It seems to be every few days another drama, another scandal, another problem that he's having to deal with. And all of that distracts. It means bad headlines, and it distracts from the agenda that he wants to crack on with and sort of showing a more positive light about what he would do for the country going forward. And so therefore, it's a problem for him, as well as it possibly internally, about how it goes down that the Chinese spies tried to infiltrate his own party.
I mean, what you just said there underlines something a great political journalist said back in the 1990s, which is that accident-prone politicians don't become accident-prone by accident, I suppose. Last question. This is a very, very big argument about the balance of power in the world, economically and politically and diplomatically right now, and it will go on. And in that sense, these arguments are likely to flare up when the Labour Party's in power, or if the Labour Party takes power, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, this is the real politique of global relations rather than anything that's necessarily dictated by particular parties' views internally in the UK. And I think that what we would see under Keir Starmer, should he win the next election, David Lammy presumably be his foreign secretary, is a continuation of status quo. That everything we've heard from Starmer at PMQs and over the last few days about the government making potentially Britain more vulnerable as a result of its relations with China, it'd be very interesting to see exactly what they would do differently. Because under Keir Starmer, there has definitely been a cross-party consensus in much of their approach to foreign policy, in contrast, obviously, to his predecessor, Jeremy Corbyn. And I'm not entirely clear, if they make it into government, whether that would change at all.
So in that sense, whatever the sound and fury this week, Dan, if the Labour Party takes office, we'll carry on walking this sort of delicate and often somewhat contradictory walk, where we sort of both acknowledge that China isn't in the place we would like it to be and there are problems in our relationship with it, but nonetheless, we have to sort of leave things much as they are.
look, there'll be a mixture of muddling along and actually an honest debate about what the correct relationship is between the UK and China from the Britain's perspective. One wouldn't be surprised that will be then sort of upset by, you know, perhaps another of these kind of spying revelations. I mean, the fact that in this case we're talking about someone in conservative circles, one would hope that the Chinese can read the opinion polls and we'll see the Labour Party is on the up and might show a bit more interest in Labour. And I think that So we are likely to see these kind of things again. It's just really important that we just see them in context. You know, this is not a profound theft of state secrets. This is people floating around the edges of Parliament picking up information that, frankly, you know, good media organisations can pick up. So this is not a full on scandal. But the fact that the Chinese seem to be interested in doing this, once twice suggests that they'll do it again.
Okay, we may well be back in our position as people who, like these people, are alleged to have done hang around Westminster and see what's going on and try and get a sense of the secrets behind the facade. Okay, we'll pause there for a minute. Pippa and Dan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. When we come back after the break, we're going to be looking at dangerous dogs and disposable vapes and why both could be banned.
Hello guys, this is Shantae, the host of the Guardian's Pop Culture podcast. We're back for more. And listen, when it comes to pop culture, if you're talking about it, we've got it covered. As an extra treat for you, I'm going to be at the London Podcast Show in King's Place on Sunday the 17th of September with the expert matchmaker Paul C. Brunson. You know, our fave Married at First Sight expert. Do you want to find your perfect partner in life? Then you have to come and see us. Paul has all the tips and tricks. Get your tickets in person or go to kingsplace.co.uk/popculture.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back. By now, if you own a smartphone, you will have probably seen the video of an American bully dog attacking an 11-year-old girl and two men in Birmingham. It's a pretty horrific video. That breed of dog has been linked to 14 deaths in the UK since 2021. If you want to picture them, they are heavy set, really, really heavy, it is said, as a muscular adult man in many cases. And they're a crossbreed between an American Pitbull Terrier and an American Staffordshire Terrier. Anecdotally, a vet we spoke to before we started recording this podcast said that some people who've worked on these bully dogs were terrified that one bite on their hand could end their career as a vet. I've got The Guardian Zoe Williams with me in the studio now. Hello, Zoe.
Hello.
You've written about this recently, haven't you?
Yeah.
Tell me why.
Well, I mean, I thought about this a lot because, you know, ever since 91, which was kind of the start of my career, there have been kind of periodic moral panics about breeds of dogs. So in the Dangerous Dogs Act, it was pit bulls.
That was the Dangerous Dogs.
Yeah.
The Dangerous Dogs Act was passed in 1991 when John Major was the Prime Minister.
And it was preceded by exactly this conversation, which was a kind of these dogs are born bad. The kind of weight per jaw per square inch of jaw is unlike anything you would find outside a zoo. That is also true of the Staffy. That's true of the Mastiff. That's true of the Pitbull. It's actually the fact that bullies are 60 kilos rather than 30 kilos it doesn't actually make a huge amount of difference to the jaw strength, which is phenomenal, you know.
Right.
A pit bull could end your career. Couldn't end your career because you're mainly a chatter, but it could end my career.
Right, go on.
So you kind of see these kind of moral panics come up, and you see a huge amount of very kind of febrile discussion around types of dog, which kind of comes apart from anything resembling a sensible approach.
Right, okay. But if you're talking about sensible, the figures do seem to be stark, right? Between 2001 and 2021, there were an average of 3 deaths caused by dogs a year. In 2022, there were 10. And so far in 2023, there have been 5. And since the start of 2022, American bullies have been responsible for 11 of the 15 deaths recorded. That's
lot. No. I'll tell you exactly why they're a particular problem. And what the first reason is that they're overbred. Now, you get temperamental problems with overbred dogs.
Now, what does that mean?
Well, it's basically if a bitch has a litter and then has a litter too soon after the previous litter, the dogs are weird.
Okay. But and clearly, if you get behaviourally weird dogs, so if you that's get sufficiently strong that they can kill people, you've got a big problem.
Yeah, it's a massive problem. I wasn't ever saying it wasn't a problem. But what I was saying was that if you get a conversation into which a lot is freighted that isn't actually about a dog, then you start trying to pass legislation which doesn't help, right?
Okay. One of the things that you have raised in your writing about this is that you think there is a class element to this story.
Yeah,
right?
I think there's a massive class and race codification to all kinds of dog panics, right? So you very rarely...
This one included?
Yeah. Definitely, okay. Definitely. And certainly with the way people talk about them, they always talk about the kind of the wrong kind of people owning them as status dogs. Whenever people say status dogs, they almost always mean young black men. They don't mean middle-class women. They don't mean working-class women even. It's really gender, race, class-coded. And I find, you know, leaving aside the fact that I don't like class war, I especially don't like it when it's played in kind of shadow puppetry. When people say inexperienced owners, status dogs, irresponsible owners, they're basically saying this kind of dog is owned by this kind of young man.
Are they? Are they saying that they tend to be owned by irresponsible people? Because no. why else would you want a dog?
Yeah, but John,
which is known for being volatile and might kill people.
Well, no, it's loads of stuff going on there. I mean, I don't know where you are on dogs. Do you like dogs?
No, I don't. I'm not a dog person.
So,
really.
So you're not really going to get having a dog.
No, I get having a dog. I don't know why you have to have one that could conceivably kill someone.
Yeah, exactly. You're not going to get why anybody would have a mastiff if they could have a shih tzu. Do you know what either of those are?
No, but one sounds more harmful potentially well, than the other.
Well, mastiffs are massive,
yeah,
right?
Okay.
And they're potentially incredibly dangerous dogs, but
yeah,
they aren't often very dangerous dogs because they're kennel club verified. They're incredibly carefully, the bloodline is incredibly carefully tended. Everybody knows one mastiff from another.
But you don't think wanting one of these dogs
against
wanting a Labrador or a Dalmatian might say something about you and say toxic masculinity, for example?
No, I really don't. Because it's like you wouldn't say that about a mastiff because they're not associated with the working classes.
Ah,
but they are.
In other words, it's arbitrary. Yeah, there are some potentially dangerous dogs, which we don't talk about.
Which we never
because
say.
Because they're not associated with those stereotypes.
We never say, why would you want a mastiff? Look at its gigantic head. Its head is bigger than yours. Who would want that dog? Even though, you know, you would probably think that. You would never say it. Evan Davis would never say it on Radio 4 because it's not a class.
But your point is that there are middle and upper class people who are in possession of potentially dangerous dogs who get off scot-free. They're not included in this conversation.
That's actually not my proposition at all. I mean, I think if you're a kind of middle class person who happens to like a bull breed, you end up accidentally tarnished with the same class hatred.
And that's happened to you,
working
I think,
class
hasn't
owners.
It?
Yeah, definitely.
You have a crossbreed of a Staffordshire Bull Terrier and a Rhodesian Ridgeback.
That was my first dog. And it bit
your mum, did it not?
Well, she was big. She was being really annoying. that's a side issue. But
is it?
Yeah.
Isn't that a direct experience of exactly what we're talking about?
No, because actually, if that had been if he had been a volatile dog, he would have she wouldn't have walked away from that. would have been career changing.
But you feel
there's a ladder,
repeatedly you've been sort of unfairly maligned and even insulted for the fact that you've got a Staffordshire Bull Terrier.
To take one question at a time, there's a ladder of aggression, right? And volatile dogs move up the ladder very fast. Often you'd be in a bad situation before you knew it had even started. with a volatile dog.
So you might be right that there is a certain class and race, for that matter, element to the way that this story is being reported and the way that some of these dogs are being understood. But there's another class element to this, arguably, which is that if middle-class people had been mauled to death by dogs in these numbers, everyone would be going crazy. And the story about this somewhat is people who tend to live in somewhat deprived and marginalised communities, you've died in horrible ways, kids included, and not nearly enough of us.
Well, I disagree that we could be going any crazier, because we're already going crazy, right? We're talking about this round the clock, and everybody's become very polarised very fast, and half the people are like, all these dogs should be exterminated right now, and half the people are like, it's not the dog, it's the owner. But the truth is,
I think
exactly the same now as I thought in 1991.
Which is what?
Which is, you're not actually helping banning the breed. What would help is if you had good evidence that a breed was predisposed towards aggression, you'd have a muzzle order on that breed. And then what's the worst that could happen?
Okay.
And it's so easy, but because nobody really, this is what I mean by a moral panic, nobody really wants an easy answer. It's a kind of necropolitics. People want the kind of answer. They want eye for an eye discussion. They want a discussion that ends in violence, whether that's a violence against a whole breed of dog or whether that's a kind of violence against which class is most serious conversation.
So you'd have muzzle orders. Would you?
I would have a muzzle order.
Would you be all right
sure.
with harsher penalties for the owners of dogs who maul people?
But they've already got really hard.
It's a
14-year prison sentence.
In 2022, offenders on average were ordered to pay £813, with victims receiving only £585 in compensation.
Yeah, but that will relate.
That's according to the Times.
That will relate to how bad the injury was. I mean, if the injury was really bad, then that penalty will be much more stringent. I don't want to sound like a broken record, but if you look at the convictions for dangerous dog ownership versus, say, rape convictions, then you'll see that it's actually pretty stringent.
I sense there's another thing within this, which is a sort of broader point about the politics and the practical effects of banning things, right? Yeah, yeah. Which is that banning things, certainly when it comes to things like this, drugs arguably is another example, doesn't get rid of the problem. It just pushes it somewhere else. And if you're not careful, it makes it worse, right?
I think if you
it's
ban
sort of stupid
them,
and futile politics.
Yeah, it's stupid and futile. B, you don't actually have the architecture to keep on top of every single XL bully in the country. So all you're doing is kind of chasing underground what are quite a large number of them. And that...
No, I was reading, for example, only a moment ago that there are still around 2,000, it is reckoned, pit bull terriers in the country, even though they were ostensibly banned in 1991.
Oh, yeah, but that's because you can get an exemption. If you can show that you've got a really nice, well-trained pit bull, you can get an exemption. You can get a certificate of exemption.
Let's talk about the politics of banning as far as they extend or may extend soon to disposable vapes. I don't want to put you through the grinder here, but you own a Staffordshire Bull Terrier.
I feel
and
like
you
I'm...
vape as well, don't you? So you're the ideal person to ask about both these things.
I feel like I'm the poster girl for everything that's gone wrong with society.
Yes, you've got a small boat in your garden as well, so I'm told. Now, it is said that they should be banned because we've got a huge problem with litter, chiefly. But also that there is an issue with the disproportionate marketing. Are you having a vape now in the studio?
I'm vaping while I've got like an amazing ability to not to vape and nobody notices. Like it's like
well,
my middle-aged cloak of invisibility because it's.
But that's not a disposable vape, is
no,
it?
No, of course not.
That's
no.
an old person.
I mean, I find disposable vapes very uneconomical. I don't know why the kids use them.
But they're disproportionately marketed at kids. That's the other thing.
Well, have you seen them?
No, I've seen them lying on the road. People have got rid of them. I mean, I've seen people smoking them at a distance or vaping at a distance.
They're so extraordinary because you go into a shop and they're these kind of candy colours and some of them have got squiggles. And it's a bit like going. It's a bit like discovering eyeshadow for the first time. When you go into a MAC store when you're 12, you just look at one and you want every single one you can see. Your eyes pop out their head. It's like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I think if somebody said to teenagers that you can vape, but you have to have one of these ridiculous kind of clunky steampunk ones like what I've got.
Yeah.
Then it might put some of them off.
But in that sense, again, you acknowledge that there is a problem here.
Mm. I mean, it depends what you mean. If you mean there's a litter problem, then for sure.
Well, if nicotine is being sort of brazenly marketed at children and young people, who, yeah, from what I'm told, then become sufficiently addicted that after about 15 minutes in class, they start getting really, really twitchy, right? Then you've got a problem.
Well,
let alone with all the great piles of discarded disposable vapes littering the pavement.
I mean, you used to smoke, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I smoked when I was at school. I smoked since I was 13. I don't remember being a real problem for teachers because I wanted a cigarette.
I'm not sure I was ever properly addicted, to be honest.
Oh, I was really, really addicted.
Yeah, but that's not an argument for not doing anything.
I'm just saying that you're doing a bit of a reductio ad absurdum, as ever, which is like you kind of take these kind of Daily Mail moral panics.
What,
oh,
me
my
personally?
God, teenagers are completely uncontrollable.
Me personally.
Because they're all, yeah.
No, I'm just presenting you with what is said about these things. It doesn't mean I think it's a matter of huge urgency. Because you have interesting opinions, I'm curious to know. In this case, as with dangerous dogs, right, what you would do about disposable vapes?
Well, I mean,
given half the chance.
For a start, I'd have a sense of proportion, and I wouldn't listen to everybody who says that kids are kind of suddenly unmanageable because of nicotine. Secondly, is there a case to answer that you shouldn't be selling them like sweets to kids? Yes,
yeah.
But it's within the wit of man to kind of say 16's over and over. It's quite hard to get a drink in a pub now if you're 15.
But there is a point here, isn't there, about the sort of phase of politics that we're in.
No,
this is what happens when politics runs out of road.
Yeah, really. I think the vapes thing is politics running out of road. And I think the XL bully conversation is a sort of, it's part necropolitics, it's part class war, it's part moral panic. And it's got all those components of a conversation in which a lot is being said, which is not being explicitly said. And the conversation gets very heated and very, very hysterical, very fast. And I would be sad to see a lot of dogs exterminated on that basis.
Sounds like a increasingly familiar description of the sort of dead end that politics has arrived at for the moment.
Yeah, basically.
Right, thank you for coming in.
No, my pleasure.
Thanks for listening. I should say that this week's Science Weekly podcast is also looking at dangerous dogs and more specifically whether any dog is inherently dangerous. So please do go and have a listen to that for a different side to this issue. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Politics Weekly UK. If you did, make sure you subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts and even better, leave us a review. Shantae Joseph returns to pop culture on Thursday the 14th of September. The series has already explored whether AI is going to ruin music as we know it and if astrology is changing our love lives. Now the series is back with new guests and it's going to look into brand new trending pop and internet culture stories. New episodes will appear every Thursday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts. This episode of Politics Weekly UK was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier and the executive producers are Matt Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.